Chapter the Eighth. I returned to Dr. Rogostin's office in an uncertain frame of mind. Poor Cecily, poor high-minded, artistic, free-spirited girl. I knew how she felt as the whole world seemingly attempted to break that spirit. I knew what it was like to be a young female utterly at the mercy of relatives and legal guardians, forced into obedience. Only my mother's cleverness had saved me. How was I to save Lady Cecily? After lighting the gas lamps, I made immediately for the bookshelves and seized upon Boyle's, one's indispensable guide to the aristocracy. Having had no luncheon made me cross and stubborn, so much so that I refused to go home for dinner. Instead, I sat down at once to look up Inglethorpe and Merganza, then proceed onward to other references until eventually I pieced together a sequence of events. The father of Eustace, Aquila, and Otelia, I discovered, had been the merest baronet, Sir Dorian Alastair, baronet. Not a lord, not even a member of the peerage. Moreover, his means had been in no way equal to his aspirations. However, he and his wife had put on a good show when it came time to launch their two daughters into society, and both Otelia and Aquila apparently had possessed sufficient beauty and charm, although I found this hard to imagine, to marry up. Eustace also had done very well by marrying Lady Theodora. Boyle's took me no farther, but from my personal knowledge, having met Lady Theodora, apparently the heavens were to be blessed that Sir Eustace's children took after their mother, not their father. I knew that Lady Cecily vehemently disagreed with her father's views of charity, he gave none, society, heights to be climbed, and a woman's place, obey. I wondered how much Lady Cecily's cousin, whom she was being forced to marry, resembled her father. How very unfair that such an innocent, intelligent, sensitive girl, Cecily would have given her shoes to a beggar, that such a young lady should have been, first, cursed with Sir Eustace for a father, then kidnapped by a conniving villain, and now locked in a room and starved. Where? Boyles gave me Baron Merganza's London address, and it seemed sensible to start looking there. At once. One cannot always and forever be changing clothes, especially if one were to have a look at the Merganza residence while there was still some daylight. The brown tweed suit will do, I told myself firmly. It was dark enough, as were my grey stockings and brown boots. The only thing likely to give me away in the night was my white collar, which I could remove when it was time. Thinking along these lines, I delayed only to snatch up several potentially useful items, jamming them into a carpet bag. Swinging this, I hailed a cab, a four-wheeler. "To Oakley Street," I told the driver, "and then just drive slowly." While sighing over the fee the man named, I reminded myself that in this vehicle I could see without being seen. A very good thing, as I am sure my jaw dropped to my collar ruffle when I sighted the house. Could I have mistaken the address? No. The numbers were quite clearly displayed upon the gatepost of the spiked wrought-iron fence which surrounded an ivy-shrouded mansion amid copper beeches, their spreading limbs and odd russet leaves shading the grounds. Yes, there had been beeches, but could I be confused in my recollection? I certainly hoped so. A couple of blocks farther on, signalling the driver to stop, I told him to turn around and drive slowly back again, so that I could take another look. Which, no happier than the first, confirmed what I wished not to be the case. Baron Merganza's London home, an exceedingly ugly, pointed Gothic edifice of steeply gabled grey stone, very likely complete with gargoyles, was the self-same place at which, as a midden-picker, I had encountered a large and unpleasant man, a quite ferocious mastiff, and most peculiar, a sunk fence. I now realized who that ha-ha man must be, having seen him today, expensively dressed, although most incongruously consorting with orphans, a circumstance which failed to lessen my fear of him, in a location that could hardly be coincidental. Turning matters over in my mind, I felt dreadfully weary, entertaining a strong desire to go home and rest. Instead, I had the cab drive me towards Covent Garden, where at a busy corner I dismissed it. From a street vendor I purchased some biscuits and a lemonade, forcing myself to eat and drink as I considered what I might do next. Then, after a bit of wandering, I found a butcher's stall where I bought a large soup bone with plenty of tasty-looking meat and gristle on it. This, I thought as I stowed it, well wrapped in brown paper, in my now bulging carpet bag, would distract the mastiff while I climbed the fence. As for crossing the ha-ha, well, I had learned my lesson a few weeks prior when I had found myself climbing the wall of a most precipitous house, nearly falling half a dozen times before I had made my way to the rooftop, which had proved to be no less treacherous, plummeting me through glass. But I digress. My point is that after surviving this fiasco with nothing worse than a few cuts, I had purchased a goodly length of strong rope and promised myself that never again would I venture into any irregular situation without it. Indeed, its tidy coils nestled beneath the soup bone in my carpet bag. With the rope I should be able to improvise some way to achieve the other side of the ha-ha. After which, I tried to plan as I walked to the nearest underground station and waited upon the platform for the train that was to take me back towards my fateful destination, after which all I needed to do was get into the house, evade detection, find Lady Cecily, release her from captivity, and bring her away with me? Heaven help me. Quite a bit later, when it seemed reasonable to think that folk were abed, after the house windows had gone dim and the streets quiet, except for the monotonous tread of the constable, I slipped up to a certain wrought-iron fence beside the carriage house this time. There I unwrapped the soup bone from its brown paper and lobbed it into the Maganza yard through the bars, pleased to see it land just where I intended, in front of the doghouse. I expected that the mastiff would then come charging out and give a woof or two before he discovered his treat. However, the dog did not bark. Indeed, I saw no sign of him. As before, gas jets ranged around the outside of the house lit up the environs. What a reckless expenditure! And I waited several moments, expecting the dog to appear out of some shadow, but he did not. Might he be sound asleep in his lair? I mistrusted such good luck, but saw no alternative except to continue. Softly I made my way to the corner of the fence behind the carriage house, where the friendly shadows gathered thickest, and there, hanging my carpet bag from my belt and knotting my skirt above my knees, I climbed. No stable boy shouted as I let myself down the fence's inner side. No watchdog barked. No alarm of any kind sounded. Rather than soothing my apprehensions, however, the silence worried me. It seemed too lucky, as if I might be entering a trap. Yet I felt there was no choice but to go on. And next I had to find a way across the sunk fence. Before moving out of the shadows, I got down close to the ground, because I knew from my childhood experience of country life that this was what poachers did in order to make themselves less likely to be seen when venturing across open expanses of forbidden land. Crawling, therefore, I crept towards the edge of the ditch, alert in every sense for any disturbance in the night. Even my skin and the roots of my hair seemed to hearken. I heard the distant rumble of wheels and clop of hooves on cobbles, the equally distant creak of some privy door swinging on its hinges, and high overhead, beech leaves rustling in a light breeze. Nothing more. Until a voice spoke from somewhere quite nearby, shocking me rigid. In a pent whisper it said, "Confound the entire wretched business!" A man's voice. "I shall be a laughing-stock," he whispered on with the fervour of one who vocalises merely to rid himself of unruly emotion. "How could I fail to foresee a device so childishly simple?" He spoke, I realised, from the depths of the ha-ha. His was a voice I had heard before. Somehow my body recognised it in advance of my mind, which still lacked proper function due to shock and terror. But my skin and my limbs felt no fear. Quite the opposite. They hurried me forward, still crawling, until I could look over the edge into the ditch. 10 feet from me, at the bottom of that dark abyss, the midnight mutterer had lit a match in order to study his predicament, so I saw him clearly. He wore black clothing, a black cap, and he had darkened his face with soot, but I knew him readily enough.
My brother Sherlock.